Okay, I think everybody at this point should have a copy of the introductory outline to 1 Corinthians. If you do not have a copy, there are a few left on the table back in the vestibule, and there are some on the table here at the front, and you will be able to follow along as we proceed with this introduction to 1 Corinthians. That being the case, and obviously our intention is to begin a class and a study of Paul's first epistle to Christians in ancient Corinth. And with that said, well, one more thing I do want to point out, that next Sunday we will be engaged in a meeting, and Brent Willey will be preaching during this class hour. The study questions then for the following week will be on the table in the back, and you can pick those up the next week. All right, let's get started then with this introduction. And we're going to try to locate ourselves here on particularly where the city of Corinth is. It is located, of course, on the Peloponnesus, the southern part of Achaia, and in thus the southern part of Greece. What we're looking at, the lines you see on this map, is Paul's second preaching journey, and what we want, let's see if I can find my little arrow.
Jerry?
Yes.
Is your mic off?
I thought I had it on. Sorry about that. Does that help? Okay. It's a lot better over the public address system than if I yell, so rely on the public address system. We are looking at in terms of our area, let's have a little cooperation here. I'm going to have to go ahead and use the screen over here, but we looking at this area right here, here is Corinth sandwiched on this map between these two cities, Lechium and Cenchrea. And there is actually more space on that isthmus than the map shows, but the dots had to be overlapped in order to accommodate the map itself. The city of Corinth was extremely important commercially and militarily. And that is because of these seaports that are here, Lechium. Lechium would, as your outline indicates, opens to the Adriatic and then to the Mediterranean. I indicate in the outline that this is westerly, and that's roughly true, but obviously, as you come out of Lechium here into the Gulf of Corinth, and let's go to our next map, I think that'll give us a little wider picture of this, that actually Italy would be more, it is westerly, but it's actually more northwest or even north by northwest, coming out of Lechium through the Gulf of Corinth and thus on northward into the Adriatic. Port of Cenchrea here opens into the Saronic Gulf and thence to the Aegean Sea and to the open Mediterranean down here, and hence to places of interest and commercially important in Asia. And by the way, just if there was no nomenclature on this map, none of these names, how many of you would know what this island is? Do I hear it?
Sicily.
Mark and I were watching Jeopardy one night not too long ago, and it was during their collegiate contest week. So these are college students, and the Jeopardy question, the final question, the big one, was, can you name this island? One of them guessed Fiji, which is in the South Pacific. And the other two both guessed Cyprus. I don't think they teach geography in school any longer, I would suppose. I think most of you who are of any age at all learned that Sicily is on the toe of Italy's boot along about the, what, the fourth or fifth grade, maybe not later than the eighth grade. Well, that's just a picture then of where Corinth is located. The isthmus here, its widest point is about 3.5 miles. And so it requires some portage for goods to cross through it, commercially speaking, and serving commercial purposes. And let's take a look at some of that. This is the what is left of the ancient port of Cenchrea, and not much left, but at least it bears witness to the fact that there had been a seaport there. This is a modern picture of this isthmus, and notice that there is now a canal all the way through this thing. Now, when and going back in our map just a little bit, go back to this one. This was very dangerous sailing around this area as well as much longer, and so being able to get across this isthmus with goods saved a lot of time and quite a bit of dangerous work as well. And so eventually this canal was built through it. But looking at this, this is a Diolcos. It's of ancient times. It traverses the entire isthmus, 3.5 miles. And it used to be said that that ships would be towed from one end of this thing to the other. But you think about that. If you were a ship's captain, how would you like to have your ship dragged over rocks like this? Not much, right? So the more prevalent thinking now is that goods would be offloaded at one end of this, whichever end the ship came into, and then would be put on some sort of vehicle, gondola, sled, something, and be dragged across this and then onloaded to a waiting vessel for further voyage in whichever direction they might have been going. This is the way the canal looks today. And let's take a little more up close look. How about that? That is solid rock. Nero tried to dig his way through this thing and build this canal and gave up on it. There is a plaque there today that speaks of the fact that Vespasian, I remember him, Vespasian is the general who was in charge of Roman military forces and the Jewish uprising in Judea and other locations beyond Judea, and eventually with the fall of Jerusalem. Nero had graciously, I think that's an appropriate term, giving who and what Nero was, committed suicide, and there were two or three fellows that tried to usurp the throne, and Roman rule at that point was somewhat chaotic. Vespasian was called back to Rome, and he was crowned emperor. Titus, his son, was left to finish the conquest and destruction of Jerusalem. But on this plaque, it just simply, it doesn't talk about all of that, but it talks about the fact that Vespasian, in about 66 A.D., now our calendar today is about 4 years fast. Actually, we would be looking at A.D. 2010 on a corrected calendar. So given that fact, A.D. 66 would, by our calendar, be what? A.D. 70. Now, when did Jerusalem fall? A.D. 70. And Vespasian, with an abundance of slaves, again undertook to dig through this isthmus to build this canal, and using slave labor, thousands upon thousands of slaves. Where do you suppose he got all those slaves? They're Jews, in all likelihood. If you will, let's just take a little bit of a side trip here. Turn to the book of Deuteronomy. This is chapter 28. This chapter in Deuteronomy has parallels. For example, Leviticus 26, in which Moses is laying out all of the blessings that God promised in covenant relationship in the law of Moses. But then the coin is turned over, and there is this very stark, very grim picture of what's going to happen to Israel if she is not faithful in keeping that covenant. Now that's what Deuteronomy 28 is about. So let's notice something here in particular. At verse 1 on down through about verse 14 are the blessings of the covenant. Then verse 15 begins with curses that will derive if Israel does not keep this covenant. And then finally, down at verse 67 is a depiction of a people in just tremendous despair. In the morning you shall say, oh, that it were evening. And at evening you shall say, oh, that it were morning. There are people that are wishing their lives away because of their desperate situations. And then that verse goes on to say, because of the fear which terrifies your heart, and because of the sight which your eyes see, and the Lord will take you back to Egypt. Now, where did these people come from? Out of Egyptian bondage, right? And had been brought into the land of Canaan. They have not yet conquered all of that land. They will soon do so under Joshua. But God promised them, faithfulness in the covenant, you will not have any nation to worry about. You'll never go back into slavery. But if they break the covenant, the Lord will take you back to Egypt in ships, by the way of which I said to you, you shall never see it again. And there you shall be offered for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. That describes a glutted market for human beings, slaves. Vespasian had plenty of slave labor available to work on this thing, but how many men would it take with picks and shovels and crowbars and gads operated with a hammer to work their way through all that rock? Well, more than even Vespasian had, and he gave up on it. In the 19th century, a French engineering company undertook this with modern equipment and means, and thus the canal today. What you're seeing here on this slide is a small, not an ocean-going tanker like the big ones we are used to now, but a smaller tanker being towed through this canal. And again, this cuts off a tremendous amount of sailing around the Peloponnesus and from one side, Aegean to Adriatic on the other. All right, let's go to the city of Corinth, the ancient city. This is the Acro-Corinth, this elevated rock in the background. It was this city's fortress. There was a fortress built upon it, and also, as your outline indicates, the temple of Aphrodite was found here. But all of these ancient cities usually relied upon an acropolis, the highest point. And there would be a fortress built there so that when the city was attacked, the population simply resorts to this acropolis, because with the weapons of warfare of that day, higher ground is much easier to defend. Of course, that's a general rule anyway, but I think with modern warfare, would you want to be on top of that thing facing an enemy who had smart bombs and GPS-guided artillery and this sort of thing? I don't think so. But you can imagine, with the weaponry of that day, just handheld weapons, an enemy trying to traverse this tremendous rock about 2,000 feet above sea level in order to attack that fortress. And so that was what the Acropolis was all about, and this one is the Acro-Corinth. Okay, as we go along, if you got any questions, don't hesitate to let me know. We'll try to comment on whatever it is that you would wish to discuss. The city itself was conquered about 120 B.C. by a Roman consul, Lucius Mummius, and it pretty much lay in ruins for a good long while. It was simply plundered, destroyed, and left. But Julius Caesar will rebuild the city, AD 44. I've read a date, AD 46, so, you know, give or take. But AD 44 seems to, pardon me, not AD, BC 44 seems to be the date that is most commonly settled on. Now, the city was populated at that point. It wasn't turned back over to the Greeks, but rather it was populated by freed men. Now, these would be bond servants, slaves that had gained their freedom, and they were, of course, rewarded in this case with being put in charge of this colony, this Roman colony, to populate it and to rebuild it. You recall when Paul was arrested in Jerusalem, the Jews that were enraged with him were about to beat him to death, and he is rescued by a Roman commander, Claudius Lysias. And Claudius is trying to figure out what it is these people have against Paul. And he allows Paul to speak. And Paul does so in the Hebrew tongue, and so his Hebrew audience listens to him until he says to these Jews that he was serving God faithfully, God having sent him to the Gentiles, and then this Jewish crowd went into ballistics. And the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias, he doesn't have a clue. So he takes Paul into the Roman barracks, and he's going to question him there, and the Romans would question one by scourging. And so they bind Paul, and as they do so, Paul asks, is it lawful for you to bind a man who is a Roman citizen and unconvicted? Remember that? So Claudius Lysias, the centurion who's in charge of this beating, the scourging, goes to his commander, Claudius Lysias, and tells him this. And Claudius Lysias now is really upset because he could be in really deep trouble, maybe even to the point of death for treating a Roman citizen like this. So he comes to Paul and he asks him, are you a Roman? What is Paul's answer? Yes. And Claudius Lysias says, I obtained this with a great sum. In other words, he had bought it. What was Paul's response to that? I was born a Roman. Now, we don't know, at least I don't know, any more about Paul's background than that, but he was a Roman citizen. Well, this Claudius Lysias would have been what? A freed man. Okay, and so that's the kind of people that Rome sent and to repopulate, to rebuild the city of Corinth. Just one other note on that. Remember when Stephen was in this great conflict with Jews in a synagogue? It was the synagogue of what? The old King James says libertines. That's not a real good translation. But the synagogue of freed men. Now here were Jews, still worshiping God as Jews, but they had been released from their bond servant status. They were freed men. So we encounter that term from time to time. The Isthmian Games. Now, they were second only to the Olympian Games of Athens, and they're reinstated, so the city is returning to its glory. They're reinstated in honor of, pardon me, Poseidon, the god of the sea. Now, how do you pronounce that word? Poseidon? Well, let me maybe explore something. I don't know what's happened to all of our tools. It's supposed to be a marker up here somewhere, and I cannot find it. There's a small one. I think that'll do. The middle of this word, let me be sure I get that spelled correctly. Yeah. Oh, well, this is the part right here that's of interest. These two letters right here, called a diphthong. Now, what is a diphthong? You all know, because you use it all the time.
Two vowels that are together that form one
sound. All right, two letters that are pronounced as one. Are we familiar with this? Well, let me ask you this. There's our diphthong. How do you pronounce that?
A.
It's an A. Great. How do you pronounce it? It's a long A. Right? Okay. So, in our movies and TV shows and all sorts of stories nowadays, we get this as Poseidon. But what's the diphthong? A. Poseidon. And when you talk to somebody, you say, have you seen that movie? The Poseidon? They're going to say, what? That's Poseidon. Right? So that's the way it's pronounced today. And I just don't think that's correct. But correct or not, that's the way it's pronounced. And so as long as everybody knows what we're talking about, well, I guess we can get along on it. But I think that's a point of interest, at least a little bit of a side note here. Corinth is a site of commerce, of art, of tremendous wealth, of intellectual pursuits. It had its share of Greek philosophers and other deep-thinking minds according to the measure of the world. Abounded with leisure, people who had plenty of time. There's a reason for that, and we'll get into that in just a moment. But it's a center then of influence. From the east through this isthmus of Corinth, information comes and it goes westward. Or the same from Rome and other parts of the European world coming southward and then eastward through the isthmus, it impacts Asia. So all of this sort of thinking back and forth. But it was an area of considerable philosophical and cultural interest, and as a consequence, it had a great impact upon both sides of the world. Now, notice at number five here on your outline, and this is a point that really impacts our study of the book of 1 Corinthians, because Paul is going to have to deal with this problem, that Corinth was renowned for its immoral, licentious atmosphere. If you open a Webster's Collegiate Dictionary of our day, obviously the first primary definition of the word Corinthian is a citizen of Corinth. But the second or a secondary definition of the term is a gay, and that word gay does not mean, with Webster's definition, what it means today, a male homosexual. It just means a person who's a party guy, somebody who's on the wild side. A gay in the sense of profligate, that is, degenerate man. And a fashionable man about town, especially sportsman. Now, that word sportsman doesn't describe a fellow who is a fan of Major League Baseball or the NFL or the NBA. That's not what this word meant in this context. I guess it's poignant a way to put across what this term means in this context is that brothels were once referred to as what? Sporting houses. So the sportsman in this use of the word and in this context is anything but complimentary. It describes an immoral, profligate man. Charles Pfeiffer, in his very well-known, very much used book, we've got, I think, at least one copy, maybe more, in our library of Baker's Bible Atlas, says that Corinthian means to live, or to live like a Corinthian, became synonymous with a life of luxury and licentiousness, that is, immoral attitudes and conduct. John McKay, in his book, Archaeology and the New Testament, makes a similar reference, and just make note of that. There's a reference there, and you can look that up if you want to. Now, it is the site, then, of the Temple of Aphrodite. That's the Greek name for this goddess. The Roman name, one we're more familiar with, is Venus. Okay, the goddess of love and fertility. This temple housed, it's been estimated, as many as 1,000 cult prostitutes. Now, these are probably slaves. These are not women who volunteered to do this, but these are probably slaves who have been devoted to Aphrodite by their idolatrous masters. And fornication was an integral part of the pagan worship of Aphrodite, contributing to the city's immoral culture and reputation. I think sometimes when we talk about idolatry in our day, we tend to think of it as the foolishness of a person just deciding, okay, I'm not going to worship God. I'm just going to bow down to this rock or to this or that image that's been made by man. Let's see if we can perhaps rethink that just a little bit. Here in general, you're going to have to pardon my artistry or lack of it, but here's a human being. The human being is created by whom? By God, and in whose image? God's. So if a person created in the image of God worships God, which direction is he looking? He's looking upward. Paul said, set your affections on things above, not on things on the earth. But human beings throughout history have tended to create gods in whose image? Their own. And if man creates an image in his own, which direction now is he looking? Well, inevitably, he's looking down here. And Paul's description in Romans, the first chapter, of idolatry is, I think, the clearest, simplest, best definition you'll ever find anywhere. Men who, knowing God, were not chose not to serve Him, to know Him, but rather created images in the likeness of man, birds, four-footed beasts, creeping things. These idols that men created, since they were creating a god in their image, always had what kind of characteristics? not spiritual characteristics, but characteristics that are of a fleshly nature. God, a God that is a God of, that brings fear to the heart. A God that appeals to the lust, as Aphrodite. Or a God that was full of fury. And on these gods went. With these qualities, less than praiseworthy qualities, when not controlled by the will of God, constitute the gods of idolatry. And so these Corinthians, now they're looking up at the temple of Aphrodite, but in their heart, which way are they looking? Down to that which is fleshly rather than spiritual. And this was just characteristic of the ancient world of idolatry. It is characteristic of our day. The humanist who claims to be irreligious, has no religion, don't buy it. There is not a person on the face of the earth who is not religious. Now, one of the things that we have, I think, encountered in our time is that trying to put the religious and the secular as dichotomies in two different areas. To be religious is to be involved in some organized ecclesiastical arrangement, a church of some kind. And the person who rejects being a member of the church is therefore not religious. Not so. If you think an atheist is not religious, just push his button and watch him go into orbit. Religion was defined, who was the psychologist? German? Say again? No, not Freud. He talked about made a list of human needs and so forth. He came under John Dewey's influence. All of a sudden, his name escaped me. I shouldn't have brought it up, right? Anyway, he came up with an interesting definition of religion. He said, anything with an object of devotion and a means of orientation, that is to direct one, is religious. What is the object of devotion of the humanist? Himself, man. And what is his means of orientation? By what guidelines does he go? Well, situation ethics. And if there being no God and thus no authority, he nonetheless comes up with that one is free to do whatever he or she wishes to do as long as he or she does not harm someone else. Who made that rule? Who says you have to live by that if there is no God? But that's the humanist. And humanism, by the way, is a little nicer word, a much more deceptive word for garden variety atheism. And that's his object of devotion, the human being. And the means of orientation is pretty much whatever he wishes it to be, given any one situation, but always with this idea that you can't harm somebody else. But without a God to enforce that rule, I don't know who would actually make it, but I hope you can see the point. One other brief example. A few years ago, the city of Eugene wanted, or at least gave authorization for the building of a parking lot, and the building of that parking lot required the cutting down of a number of trees. Now, you know what happens in Eugene when somebody cuts down a tree. Well, the people that were doing this work, they came in fast and quick and had those trees on the ground before anybody knew about it. They weren't breaking the law. They had a permit to do it. But the picture in the paper was of a number of radical environmental people. And I don't really like that word environmentalist because I think anybody who has a sense of responsibility is concerned about the environment. Are we not?
But here's a person with this radical point of view, got himself all painted up in war paint, laying on this tree, hugging it, consoling it because somebody had killed it. Does he have a God? God is the environment in which he lives, rather than the God who created it. So, idolatry is the foolhardiness of worshiping the creation rather than its creator. Yes, sir?
I think one of the things that's happening today is the terminology that people use when they're speaking of their worldview would be an objective worldview, would say, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is, truth is just something that comes outside of us to us. But a subjective worldview says, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, that's basically, to me, is a beginning of idolatry because it is something coming out of you and not something coming to you.
I think that's an accurate way to describe it. Yes.
Part of that happening today in church, I hear people that say, I feel, instead of I know. And it's really kind of creeped in the back door, I know.
Yeah, my simple little chart up here, do we look upward to God and ask him, what is your will? That's objective. Or do we look downward and simply deal with this thing from the standpoint, I feel this way about this or that, and therefore devote myself to it. Okay? All right. Let's move on a little bit here. And the last part on that section, John McRae points out that the city of Corinth was populated with about 300,000 citizens. Now, I've seen other figures that were put this closer to 250,000, but at 250,000, that's still larger than the city of Eugene. But in addition to that population of citizens, there were about 460,000, give or take, slaves. So do you see why these people had all this leisure? They're being served by slaves. It's said that about 50% of the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. And wherever they conquered people, they took slaves, just as Vespasian did out of Jerusalem and out of Judea in general. But this also tells us a lot about the nature of this city, just simply being served by and benefiting, exploiting the lives and the energies of others. Okay, we have a few minutes left. Let's go ahead and get into the beginning of the church in Corinth. I don't think we're going to have time to finish this. We will do so 2 weeks from today after Brent's meeting. But Paul is the one, of course, he and Silas, who brought the gospel to the city of Corinth. I missed something here, but not quite. We're going to talk about Paul. He arrives alone in the city of Corinth. He had sent Timothy back up to Thessalonica to console those brethren, to encourage them, and to report back to Paul on how things were going there. But in the city of Corinth, Paul will meet Priscilla and Aquila, and he will abide with them. They are of the same trade. Priscilla and Aquila had been driven out of Rome by decree of Claudius, who had decreed that all of the Jews must be driven out of Rome. So as Paul and Aquila and Priscilla working at their trade, this is a slide of the old agora, the marketplace, the court. Here's a shop or two that's still standing around that area. And it was tremendously profitable during the games that were played, comparable, as we said, to the Olympics. And just the trade that came through this city. It was tremendously commercially profitable. And so the marketplace was substantial. Now when, I've got one more slide I want to show you, but a little bit later. Well, let's go ahead and do it now, so I won't forget it. This, I've got three more I want to show you. Eventually, Paul, preaching in Corinth, he's going to get crosswise with the Jews, and they will take him before the Roman governor, Gallio, and will charge him with teaching things contrary to the law. You're familiar with that, I think, out of our study of the book of Acts. And when these opposing Jews lodge this charge against Paul, and he's brought before the Roman governor, the governor could care less about the fact that these Jews are upset with Paul, contradicting what, or at least they charge, contradicting their law. He wasn't. But if this had been a case, Galileo said, of great wrongdoing, some criminal activity, something that would have violated Roman law, then Galileo was interested in it, but this being the case, he is not, and he simply drives these Jews from before his judgment seat, and in turn the Greeks take out their vengeance on these Jews, and they beat Sosthenes, who is the ruler of the synagogue. But this is a slide showing the bema, the judgment seat. And see this little object right here? Who knows what that is? That's a pillar to which the accused was chained while being judged by the one who sat upon the bema. And stone does not wear away very fast, although these stones are a couple thousand years old or more. So in all likelihood, this very stone is where Paul was chained while he was being tried before Galileo, and of course, released. Now let's take a look at a couple of more slides here. This stone right here is extremely interesting. Why? Well, let's look at the name that's on it. The name here is Erastus. Now, this is, of course, this difficult to read. It's all in unshield writing. But this stone is just laying out in the dirt, just like you see it here. What do we know about Erastus? When Paul wrote, apparently, from Corinth, the Roman letter at chapter 16, verse 23, and gave greetings from those in Corinth to the Romans, whose name did he include? Erastus, the treasurer of the city. Now, people through the ages just pulled this stuff out of the air and put this book together, and it's really just fables and myths and made-up stories. Now, here's a real man. Acts describes him as the treasurer of the city. Here he is on this plaque that was made to him that now just lays out in the dirt. And it's an expression of gratitude to this man, the treasurer of the city, who out of his own resources made a contribution for the building of a courtyard, laying of stones and tiles and so forth. And here's gratitude being expressed to him for that. That's pretty encouraging. As you study the Bible, you go to some place in the ancient world, there's a monument with this person's name on, or some other document, some other sort of information. But I thought, to me at least, this was extremely important and very encouraging. I think, you know, as we consider the church in Corinth, and I get back to our outline here, if you were to describe the church in Corinth, what term or terms would you think of? What would come to your mind? How many of you here have been through the book of 1 Corinthians before? And they're practically everybody. What did you encounter in your study of 1 Corinthians? Problem after problem after problem. That church really had its problems. Paul was there, lived there about 18 months, worked with them. I have a hunch those were some of the longest 18 months that he ever spent in his entire life. I recall a preacher that some of you knew, very, very good, capable man, but he was encouraged to move to a place one time and moved there to help these people. with some things that they had asked him to do, and when he got there and started doing them, why, he encountered all kinds of problems that were just over the top, just incredible. And somebody asked him, how long did you ever preach in any one place? And that was the place he named. He was there 1 year. Long, long time to put up with all of that stuff. I have a hunch that Paul may have felt something like that about his stay in Corinth. But there are reasons for these problems. These people are from very different backgrounds. Again, Corinth is influenced by ideas from all over the world, both the East and the West. And these problems would still afflict these people as they are struggling with whether or not they are going to give up their past thinking and their past ways of life and submit to the authority of Christ as expressed by an apostle or not. And so there are Jews and Gentiles. Now some Jews, and I'm reading here directly from the outline, vaunting the alleged superiority of Judaism. That's a word that suggests a distinction. We sometimes look at what Paul wrote concerning these people and say they were holding to the law. No, they weren't. They were holding to the traditions of the fathers. That's what Paul said, that he had gained in status far beyond his peers, men of his own age, holding to the what? Traditions of his fathers. So at this point in time, the Jewish look at the law was just steeped in rabbinic tradition. That's what Jesus would reprove over and over again during his personal ministry. But these Jews think this is far superior to anything the Gentiles had to offer. And the Gentiles, in their loving of philosophy, they think that the Jews are just about as ignorant as they can be. And you've got Jews and Gentiles now in one congregation. You think you might have a little bit of conflict. Yeah, absolutely. And there is factionalism among these people based upon who they are most devoted to. Paul, Apollos, Cephas, that is Peter, Christ himself. And the idea here of a Christ party is one that we'll pursue when we get into 1 Corinthians 1 and over 1 Corinthians 15. F.F. Bruce has some things to say about that I don't think are set in concrete, but they're interesting and I think very, very possible. But here are people who have factionalized the gospel into these little sects, and each one vaunting himself against the other. Is that a hotbed for problems and difficulties and contention? Yeah, absolutely. And Paul is going to have to deal with that. In fact, he'll have to deal with the problem of people looking upon him not as an apostle, but one who is a second stringer, one, as Paul said of himself, born out of due season, and yet nonetheless as totally equal to the other apostles and labored more abundantly, he said, than they all. But Paul is being treated with a great measure of contempt by many of these Corinthians. Thus we have the 1 Corinthian letter. So we've pretty well covered what I wanted to say this morning about this introduction. I hope it's been helpful. One thing more I'll say before we break up. Notice on the very last page of what you have in this introduction is a very thumbnail sketch outline of the book. And we'll be studying it, looking at those particular sections as we go through our study of 1 Corinthians together. Now, thank you so much. I hope this has been helpful. If you do not have a copy of this introduction, there are still some copies available. You're welcome to take one.